This podcast is sponsored by Elspelio. If you go to elspelio.com, you can find the last light you will ever need. If you're already an Elspelio user, then you know how great the lights are. And if you're already an Elspelio user and something's gone wrong, you can get parts on the website. But you might not know that because their stuff is built so well, you might not have had to replace anything yet. But if you find yourself in that position, just go to elspelio.com, get the parts there, and see what else he's got, too. You can get a Lunatic now. You can get a Rescue SAR. The one that I've got is all sold out. That's the Terra. And maybe you were one of the ones who bought all those and caused them to run out. Have you used it yet? I love mine so much. Just charge it up overnight before a trip. And it holds on to that charge, too. It's so great. Elspelio.com, importers of fine caving lights. And right now, if you buy any light at elspelio.com and use the promo code podcast, you'll save $20 off your order. Or really any order, not just lights, at elspelio.com. If you spend more than $300 on any regular priced items, you'll save $20 with that promo code. Again, podcast at elspelio.com. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. This is a podcast about caving, which is cave exploration, although exploration can be a specific term. That can be a term for entering passage that no one has ever been in before, what we call virgin cave. And I've actually never done that. I, the host, have never been in virgin passage. I've only ever gone in caves that other people have been in before. And I often go back to the same places over and over again because I just like caving. To me, it's the ultimate adventure. It's in the dark. It's kind of cold. You got to get on your hands and knees sometimes. You got to get on your belly sometimes. You got to contort sometimes. I mean, the focus and sort of in the momentness of caving is what attracts me to it. I can't think about anything else when I'm in a cave. I've just got to stay focused on what I'm doing, where I'm at, and where I'm going. And I love that. And if that sounds like something that you might like to do and you've not done it before, I would encourage you to try it, but to do it the right way. We have some rules in caving. One rule is never go alone. And there are other rules, but I think that if you've not done it before, that's the one that you need to know first. Well, how do I find someone who wants to do it? Because I've talked to people that I know and nobody wants to go do it. And I completely understand that. Well, there are groups scattered throughout the United States called grottos. And they are local chapters of the National Speleological Society. And you can find your local grotto at the NSS website, which is caves.org. Pretty easy to remember, caves.org. Or you can just Google grotto and your location and something will come up. You get in touch with the leadership of that grotto. And there are always a few people in grottos who are going on trips often, maybe not so much now. But even now, you could get hooked up with some people who, you know, have a risk tolerance for bringing new people, and maybe you'll get to go. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, and not so much if you do. So get in touch with people who do and get to know what you're doing, and then maybe you'll be the one leading trips someday. All right, this episode is my first in a series that I'm going to do with California Cavers to promote this year's NSS convention in Weed, California. This episode is with Stephen Johnson and Marianne Russo of the Western Cave Conservancy. And we talk a lot about the conservancy. We talk about each of their individual caving lives. It was a great talk, and hang on for it. It's coming. Last month, I got to talk about virtual topics in cave rescue, the virtual series being put on by the NSS. They got a great response from people. They got a lot of people signing on and watching. And so I've been asked to mention it again. On March 10th, they're going to continue the series with a couple of great presentations. What is the difference between a small party assisted rescue or a SPAR and a call out rescue? Tom Evans is doing that one. And then a former guest of this podcast, Renee Ohms, is doing a presentation called Making Better Decisions Underground. And she is the recipient of the most recent Lou Bicking Award. So I would listen to what she has to say. On the 24th, how to wrap up your patient better than a Christmas gift and glacier cave hazards and rescue considerations for the Cascade Range. Virtual topics in cave rescue presented by the NSS. If you are not yet registered for these, you can do so at the link. I'll put it up in the description. But they're doing them on the 2nd and 4th Wednesdays through May. And it's a great resource. If you've never taken any kind of class or gone to any kind of talk on cave rescue because it's just not something you're interested in, I would still encourage you to do it. Because it's not that I'm not interested in cave rescue. Like, I'll show up if I'm called, but I'll stay out of the way when I'm not, you know. But some people get really into it, and I understand that. But it made me a better caver. I just did an orientation to cave rescue, an OCR, they call them. It was just a weekend-long thing. And it made me appreciate all the considerations that rescue people have to take into account. And I wasn't careless before, but it certainly made me less careless. Does that make sense? So anyway, link in the description to register for that and join them on March 10th and 24th. All right, so what's been going on with me? I started this new job in the middle of January. It's going pretty well. I'm getting used to the sleep schedule. I get up before 5 a.m. Eastern time every day. I'm often awake before my alarms go off, which is frustrating to me. But I'm beginning to sleep more. When my sleep schedule is disrupted, I just don't sleep. And I'm learning the value of a good nap in the middle of the day, too. Because I also have small children, and dealing with them on very little sleep is not easy. And I want to be cheerful around them. I don't want to be that dad who's always grumpy because he didn't sleep enough. So I'm working on that. But the job is going great. Like, if you have a smart speaker and you feel like listening to the radio show that I do in the morning, you know, we just play rock music. It's an adult album alternative station. So it's grown-up music, but I have a lot of fun with it. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Matt Pelser Radio if you want to follow that whole thing. I talk about caving sometimes. But yeah, if you have a smart speaker, you can ask it to play WTTS. I'm on from 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern every single day. I went hiking this past weekend with a caver, several cavers, two former guests of this podcast, Danielle Green and Chris Parks. Socially distanced, of course. We did a hike in southern Indiana. I finished the last couple miles of the Tecumseh Trail, which was a trail I did most of over 2 days back in December. I did 19 and a half miles each day because that was literally all the time that I had. And I wanted to be able to do this, but it just absolutely killed my feet. And I hadn't been on a hike since then. And I was going to actually go on a caving trip with a couple people in my bubble, my sister-in-law and her girlfriend. And that fell through because my sister-in-law's girlfriend is in insurance and she got called down to Texas. By the way, if you're down there in Texas and you had to deal with any of that, I'm so sorry. What a mess. What a tragedy in a couple cases. I hope you're doing okay. But anyway, that caving trip fell through. And so we did a hike. I think we did about 10 miles. Felt good. Brought the dogs. I got a new car. It's a little stick shift Corolla. So that was fun driving that thing through the hills of southern Indiana. It's a little different when you're on hills in a stick shift, made for a fun challenge. Anyway, that's what's going on with me. Enough of that. Let's get to Marianne and Stephen. We talked about the Western Cave Conservancy. We talked about their own personal caving lives from the beginning to the present. And as you will hear, they are both excellent natural communicators. I barely had to do any editing on this, which is always nice. Oh, and sorry for the email notification sounds. I edited them where I could, but if you hear them, that means they were in a spot where I really couldn't cut them out without losing context. So don't try not to be too distracted. And Stephen Johnson and Marianne Russo of the Western Cave Conservancy.
In California and probably the West in general, there's conservancies. A lot of conservancies in the East, I gather, are about really land acquisition. And that is often less of the case out here because there's so much public land. So it's pretty rare that interesting cave properties that are privately owned, you know, come on the market. So a fair amount of conservancy work is not merely, you know, acquiring a preserve of some sort. We're on the verge of doing our second preserve that we'll own outright. But a lot of our work is working with public agencies. Forest Service, for instance. There's a cave that we manage under an MOU with the Forest Service. There's another cave that had access issues that we worked with the Forest Service for a number of years to first actually acquire the land in a land swap with a logging company and then to work with them to ascertain that there shouldn't be any access issues due to the nature of the cave and its location and so forth. So there's a little bit of different spin on the actions that we need to do to complete our mission versus some other parts of the country.
Yeah, I would say that. And the other thing is that we started in 2003, and things have it took such a long time for us to get where we are today. In just the last year or so, things have really taken off in certain ways. But it took a lot of patience, and we really struggled to get most of the cavers kind of on board with supporting us. It was kind of hard when you don't have any caves to buy. But now that we do own some more caves, people have kind of come out of the woodwork to support us, which has been really gratifying. But it's a very different situation than it is back east, where caves are for sale more often, and people really see it as an opportunity to access caves. That's kind of it's been very nice the last few months, but before that, it was kind of a struggle.
Is there something different that you have to do with the money versus conservancies here out east? Out east, as you said, it's all about land acquisition, and you are acquiring some land. But as I understand it, Marianne, things are a lot different out there just because of the price of land.
Yeah, and that's a huge deal. I mean, where the acquisition we're making right now of the volcano caves is costing $550,000 altogether, and that's
wow.
That's wow. But
and that's for about 100. That's for about 150 acres of land.
Man.
So, but that's still, when you consider our first purchase, which was back in 2007, I believe, the Weller Cave Preserve, we paid $150,000 for that, and it's 15 acres. And that's a lot more per acre than what we're paying right now for the Volcano Preserve at $550,000. So the price per acre it varies quite a bit. But people make more money out here, and I think the thing that has allowed us to succeed and will continue to allow us to succeed is the fact that we had one caver who died a few years ago who left us a bequest of $300,000, and we invested that money, and that money has grown, and that if we hadn't had that, we wouldn't have even been able to entertain the idea of buying this large piece of property. When we got started with the fundraising, there were quite a few people who were willing to give significant amounts of money, around $10,000 or $20,000, but of course that didn't even come close. But another caver contacted me who was willing to give $100,000. And with that, and everything that we'd raised so far, along with our investments, we knew that we could manage to pay for it. But people have come forward, and so far we've raised about we're at $220,000 or so now, and when we get a matching grant from the Motherlode Grotto, we'll have $270,000. And that's we're almost up to where we need to pay the down payment. And then we'll have a couple years to raise as much of the rest of it as we can. And we're also getting a bequest. We don't know when we're going to get it, but from the Ray and Gail Beach estate. And we're going to turn that into an endowment, so that we can afford to, you know, take care of everything we have, and that will earn us extra money. So you really have to plan that way out here. You have to try and get people to give you the kind of money that you need, and then you need to invest it so that it can grow. I think that's the only reason we can really entertain any ideas of owning land out here.
Stephen, can you tell me about the volcano property? This is going to go out on the internet, so whatever you don't feel comfortable sharing is fine. But I don't know, I guess to entice cavers to maybe think about giving, what's there? Tell me about the caves.
Well, it's an area, the area that we're purchasing is about 150 acres, and it's in what's known as the Gold Country part of California. So it's sort of in the foothills, part of the area that the gold rush was in. So there is, geologically, California is somewhat of a cave-poor state. We don't have a lot of karst topography, and Gold Country is one of the areas where there is enough of that that you get a handful of caves here and there. And none of them are very large. I would say, Marianne, is there anything longer than maybe even a mile of passage in Gold Country? If there is, not very much, though.
No, Cave City is probably the longest cave.
Yeah, that's true. That's a commercial
cave. And that's commercial, yeah.
So there's a lot of interesting small caves there. And so this is an area that had been privately owned for decades. And the landowners had been very friendly and very amenable to allowing trips onto the property for caving purposes. And recently the owners needed to sell, and we were in the right position to be able to make an offer. But the property itself is nice. It's typical karst with lots of rocky outcrop here and there. There are probably on the order of a dozen known caves there, probably three of which were somewhat commonly visited by cavers. Most are beginner accessible. Some are a little bit more involved, but none are really extremely arduous. But one of the reasons we're especially excited by it is that the consensus of just about everyone who's been visiting there for a while is that it feels like there's likely to be more cave to be found there, that there are dig projects that would be productive to do. And, asking an owner to visit the caves on their land is one thing. Asking an owner, can we do digs on your land, is another story entirely. And so I'm sure some of that went on over the years, but this goes as an opportunity to much more openly and transparently explore the options and see if there really is more there.
How long had this area been known? You said cavers had known and visited this area for a good long while, and it sounds like you were dealing with particularly friendly landowners, and now you will be the landowners. How long had people been coming here?
Marianne can speak to that better than I.
Yeah, I would say easily since the 60s. It wouldn't surprise me if some of the caves were visited by the Stanford Grotto, which is no longer in existence, back in the 50s, because they were running all over the motherlode discovering caves. But when I started caving in the early 80s, and I know that people had been going there regularly since the late 60s and it's all through the 70s. However, when I first went to the caves, when I first went caving for many years, we never bothered worrying about who owned the land. If no one saw us and told us we couldn't go, we just went in. In the late 80s and certainly by the late 90s, things had changed, and you really had to try there were a lot more people living out there, a lot more signs, a lot more problems of access. So that was the property was originally owned, kind of interestingly, by Stanford University, at least during the 90s and the late 80s, as far as I know. And they sold it to the current owner and his brothers sometime, I would say, in the mid-90s. I don't know the exact date, but I know they've owned it for about 20 years, I believe. And from that point on, it's sometime we ran into Mr. Ketron, or someone told me about him. I can't remember the details, but I started contacting him. He was very nice about letting us, as long as we let him know we'd be there, we could go onto the property. So that was really nice, because we've lost access to quite a few caves over the years because of people not wanting strangers to come into their property and not even being willing to discuss the situation. So that was unusual, and it was very nice. We plan to make access to these caves rather easy. I mean, people will have to talk to the manager and just kind of make an appointment and say, and so he'll know that they're cavers and they're not, that they have the proper equipment and expertise to go there. But there's not going to be restrictions on the number of trips and that sort of thing. The caves are located probably within 2 hours of the Sacramento area, and I don't know, Stephen, what would you say, three and a half hours from the Bay Area?
Well, two and a half to three from parts of the Bay Area.
Yeah. So for California, that's pretty convenient. and so it's with having multiple caves there, you know, people can come up and spend a whole day, go to two or three caves, or, you know, look around for other possibilities. And I think, you know, it's always been a popular destination, just not people come up there a couple times a year, that kind of thing. So I think now that we are going to own it, there'll probably be more trips, but probably not significantly more.
What about the proximity to Weed, where this year's convention is going to be? How far away is that? I guess I need to familiarize myself with the geography.
Yeah. Well, I would say about 6 hours.
6 hours. Okay. So it's not likely that anyone's going to visit Volcano. Well, I mean, maybe somebody could. It's a week long, but
it's not real likely. No, it's a long trip.
And one might assume if the area is called Volcano, California, that these are lava tubes, but am I incorrect there?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So this is actual limestone karst. Okay.
Well, it's actually marble karst.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Just because of the way the geology, especially in the mother lode, is, it's all materials that were subducted down under the continent and then pushed back up. And so they underwent metamorphosis, intense heat and pressure. And it turned the limestone that developed out in the seabed, it turned it into marble. So it acts very similar to limestone, and you get the same kinds of formations and all that, but it tends to be a little bit harder than traditional sedimentary limestone.
How does that affect the actual actually moving through the cave? I mean, is it tight? Is it wide open? Or does it vary?
It varies, but an awful lot of our caves tend to form on angles. We have in certain places we have some vertical pits, but an awful lot of the caves you can see that the stuff has been tilted up, and so there's a lot of tight crawls, some open rooms, but there's a lot of caves in California that you can't really stand up very often. So it's climbing and crawling and vertical. I mean, if you don't have vertical skills out here, you're very limited in how much caving you can do.
Stephen, you were laughing. Are you used to being hunched over?
Yeah, well, I mean, California is somewhat of a cave-poor state. So if you don't want to go in tight places and don't want to do rope work, you're not going to have a lot of caves to choose from. And, you know, it may be that we say the caves are tighter, or it may just be that since we have fewer options to choose from, that we're more willing to push the tight stuff that you might be more willing to ignore in other parts of the country because you have more pleasant cave to choose from. But that's okay. All caves are interesting.
Stephen, you grew up in Alabama, but you didn't start caving until you got out to California. Do you ever go back home and do some of the great caves there?
Very rarely. So right now I have one of my sisters lives actually in Huntsville, or actually might technically be Madison. And my parents, who are elderly, recently moved up to be closer to her from the Birmingham area. So now I have both my parents and one sister in Huntsville. And obviously, I haven't been traveling much during the past year.
Yeah.
But the ironic part is actually I rarely get to do much caving when I go out there because I'm trying to maximize family time.
Yeah.
But 2 or 3 years ago, when I last went out, I realized that my sister lives literally about a 20-minute drive from Stevens Gap Cave. And she had never even not only had she never been there, she had never heard of it. And she and her husband are avid hikers, and so I was like, well, we have to go. So I dragged her out there. And she was like, how have I never even heard of this? This is amazing. So I've done a handful, but very few. And, you know, I keep hoping I will get more opportunity to go back and do more in that area. It's really just a problem of scheduling.
Sure, sure. And that's been a nightmare over the last year, as you said. Marianne, I think I interrupted you with the Stephen Alabama question. Were you about to say something?
Oh, I was just going to... Stephen introduced himself one time as being a caver from Alabama, but not having discovered caves till he got to California, was like being born in Germany and not discovering beer until you moved to Utah.
Yeah, you know, we have some caves in California that I love, but no one would say that it is the biggest outdoor charm of California. You have to pick your battles carefully to find the interesting caves out here.
Well, Stephen, what are some of your favorites out there that you frequent?
Oh, probably my personal favorites are the caves in the Marble Mountain Wilderness in Northern California. That has the Bigfoot system, which is the deepest in California at something about, it's only, I think, about maybe 1,200 feet deep. It's the second longest in California at, I think, surveyed length is probably around 18 miles. It's likely that it will probably end up being the longest when everything up there is connected, though, because Lilburn, which is the longest at, Marianne, do you remember, like 21, 22 miles?
Yeah, I think so.
Is believed to be just about played out because it's in a very constrained geological area. And Bigfoot is a case where there's clearly a large system there that may or may not currently be connected, but clearly was a big system at one time. So I suspect it at some point in the future, it will be the longest cave in California. But it's just, it's an incredibly beautiful wild area. It's all alpine caving, and a lot of it is beyond my difficulty level because you have to be prepared for cold and damp rope work and loose rock and that sort of thing. But amazing, amazing caving. So I always enjoy going up there.
Marianne, what about you? Same question. Where do you like to go?
Oh, God. Well, I've caved quite a bit back east and in the southwest. I've done a little bit of caving in Mexico and all over California. And it's really, it's hard to pick a favorite place. I suppose in California, my favorite caves were down in the Sequoia National Park. Well, there's Soldier's Cave that's in Sequoia National Park at the south end, and there's Church Cave that's actually in Kings Canyon National Park that's just at the north end of Sequoia. And there's other caves in the park, too, that I've seen, but those two I have great memories of. When I was a little bit younger and more agile, I mean, I did both those caves. They're long trips on one weekend one time, which was very memorable. And I've been up to the Marble Mountains once, and I remember a passage up there that Paul Greaves, Mother Lode Caver, who happens to be going to be our manager at the Volcano Preserve, he and I were alone in one of these passages one time waiting for a couple other people, I guess. I can't remember now. And it's so cold up there. The caves are in the 30s. And anywhere you touch the rock, it just sucks every bit of heat out of you. And we were crawling along this rocky, uninspiring, long passage. And we sat there for a minute looking at each other and thinking, this must be what caver hell is like. You know, it's ice cold and you're crawling forever.
But you're caving.
You're caving, yeah. So, of course, I never, stopped doing it. But, I don't know. Every trip is special in its own way. And I am one person that doesn't mind going back to the same caves over and over again and showing new people things. And I've really gotten a lot of pleasure out of teaching vertical technique. And I worked with NCRC for quite a while. And that gives me just sometimes just as much pleasure as actually going, doing the cave on a personal level. But, in the Southwest caves, God, I could talk about the Guadalupes and all those caves, for hours. They're just amazing. that's it. That's right. The most beautiful wild cave that I've ever been in is Cave of the Madonna.
Okay.
It's in the Guadalupes. And it's a 300-foot rappel, which is kind of breathtaking, and a beautiful room at the bottom, and then another little hole you go down, another 100 feet, and there's this long horizontal passage, which is just blows your mind. Beautiful, really wet, growing formations with pools and these things called coke tables and green water. Oh, it just was one of the most outstanding trip I've ever been on. It just
now I'm jealous. I need to find a way to go there.
Yeah. No kidding.
Oh God.
is that on like public land or is that private? You don't need to share details or anything like that. But
it's on public land. Yeah, but those caves are very restricted now in terms of access, and there are some of them. And I'm not sure about Madonna, but I suspect that that they do work trips in there, and that occasionally there's opportunities for people to visit it. When I went there in the 90s, all you had to do was drop by the Forest Service and pick up the key kind of thing. So most of them are gated.
How common is that down there in the Quads? Maybe you know a lot about the area, maybe you don't, but I mean, I know depth potential is great down there. I mean, Lechuguilla as deep as it is and everything.
Yeah.
But a 300-foot rappel, I mean, there's no long rappel like that in Lech, to my knowledge.
No, I don't think so. I think there. I think that's more of a stair step thing in Lechuguilla. I haven't been there myself, but just looking at remembering the map and everything. But the Guadalupes are in some really, they're much higher. Lechuguilla is farther down in elevation, closer to where Carlsbad is. These are way up on these high mountains up above that area. Uh-huh. And the depth of the limestone is really deep.
That's cool.
That's one thing that's really fascinating about that whole area, is that there are some caves in the reef formation which are very different, which is a different, it's a, I would imagine that it's considered part of the limestone, but it's a different sort of formation. And those are very different than the ones that are more traditional out of dissolved limestone. But there are several caves with very deep rappels up on the Guadalupe Ridge.
Stephen, have you been able to make it to the Quads for some caving?
Unfortunately, no. No, it's one of the many areas that I have not yet had the pleasure of doing any meaningful caving in.
Yeah.
The only caving remotely like that I've done in the area was really before I discovered proper caving, was going to Carlsbad and even to Slaughter Canyon Cave just on the tourist trip.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is really interesting, but it didn't occur to me that you could just find people and find a cave and just go in and just do stuff. And when I realized that, when I first discovered grottos, I was like, that's amazing. I didn't know that was a thing. So,
Marianne, you were an archaeologist. How often did caving and your professional life intersect, or did it ever?
No, it never really did. I started caving when I was 30, and I worked in archaeology until about the year 2000, but the type of work I was doing was mostly I was maintaining records for the state, and then I would go out on excavations occasionally, but they were all surface things. But it just didn't happen to intersect. Part of the problem here in California, the caves, there are a few vertical caves in the Mother Lode that have human remains in them, but they weren't, most of the archaeology we were doing was driven by development. And of course that was on areas where they could build houses and stuff. And that, you know, that didn't really occur at that time up in the Mother Lode that much. And it's still up there. They're very small subdivisions, but a lot of the houses are just being built by individuals or spec houses. And now if I had been in Nevada or something, there are a lot of caves out in Nevada that have archaeological deposits, and they're not caves that we know with long passages and everything. They're mostly rock shelters that don't go back very far. And so I knew people that worked on those kinds of projects, but that wasn't something that I ever got involved in.
Huh. Did you ever kind of wish that your professional life and your caving life had intersected? Were you kind of waiting for that, or was it just not really something that was on your mind?
No, it wasn't something that I... That really was a possibility. If I had been in a position to do more international things, like work on archaeological projects in Mexico or somewhere else in the world, I certainly could have finagled something like that, I'm sure. But I was never in a position to do that. I was taking care of my parents for years, and you know, just other life constraints. So I never really entertained the notion, actually.
Stephen, let's talk about the Weller Preserve and this collaboration with the USGS. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so that was really interesting. The USGS, in collaboration with universities like University of Berkeley, California at Berkeley, has basically been putting in seismic monitoring stations around the state. And the idea is that by gathering real-time data that and combining all the data, between them that you can sort of pinpoint and give an early warning when it looks like there's going to be a significant tremor of some sort. And one of the keys here, obviously, is that you want to have the right sort of area to put in one of these shake sensors. You want something that you have relatively solid bedrock, or, you know, solid rock not too far below. You need access to internet and to power, but also you need to be, you know, remote enough that it's interesting. And it just turned out that the Weller Preserve had a spot that was really ideal for this. It wasn't really being covered by other spaces in the web of sensor stations. And so we have a shake alert sensor out on our property now. And as a lovely side effect, it also means that we have good internet Wi-Fi available at the cave. So.
Better than I have at home.
Marianne, do we know why this was identified as a good location for this?
I think it was Matt Bowers that told Bruce Rogers, who at the time was our president, I believe, and he, one of them, contacted, you know, there was something on the internet, if you're interested or you know of a place, you know, right here, and anyway, the contact was made, and this happened to be a place that they didn't have a sensor in the immediate area, and so we made an appointment, and Bruce and myself and one of our advisors, Bill France, met with their engineer out there, and he looked it over and decided it looked really good, and it just went quickly from there. I think there's hundreds of these sites, and they're just building them all the time. It's all over California, and it actually they go up into the Northwest, into Oregon and Washington too. With the volcanoes up there, I mean, this whole area is very active seismically, and these sensors, when they're all in place, I mean, they communicate remotely with the lab in Berkeley and with other places, I'm assuming with the USGS and so forth. I don't know. Whenever the ground shakes, they immediately send the message in, and they can tell from the intensity of the shaking where this earthquake may be centered. And this, they figure this will give, ultimately give people several seconds to at least duck and cover, you know, and turn, and for hospitals to stop operating and to turn off things that need to be turned off. And so that's where they are at this point, as far as I know.
How interesting. Stephen, can you tell me about the actual caves at Weller?
Well, Weller is really one cave. If there's any other cavelets there, they're insignificant, but it's a cave that's known as Rippled, which has been known and visited since at least the Gold Rush era. I've always been told that because, you know, it's a cave and it's very temperature controlled, that the one decent sized room in the cave would actually be host to dances or something of that sort back in the gold era in the hot weather. But
actually, that was in the 30s, Stephen.
Oh, in the 30s, I stand corrected.
Yes, it was the Oneto family that owned most of that land there, built a little ladder down into there, and they built a dance floor, and during the summer they'd have dance parties in there.
Wow. You know, when we keep in mind, when we, in this part of California, when we call something a large room, people in other areas would scoff at calling this a large room. In fact, I recall a caver who was from Austria, who was studying in the area for a couple of years, and we brought him there once and said, "Oh, we have to see the large room." And when we took him in, he was just, you could see this sort of disgust on his face, like, "This is not a large room." But, you know, it's all relative. But I don't know, what would you say the dimensions are, Marianne? Like,
I would say like, maybe 60 feet by 25 or 30 feet, and probably height-wise, at the tallest point, it maybe 20 feet or so, or probably less. The tallest ceiling in the cave is 30 feet, and that's in the Ripple Passage, but that's a much narrower space. The big room is just considered big because The walls are quite a ways away from you. But like Stephen says, it's all relative. I mean, when you've been squeezing through small passages and you get someplace you can stand up and actually walk 10 or 15 steps, you're going, wow, this is big.
Now, Rippled Cave is an interesting cave for a few reasons, one of which is it's one of the few wild caves, at least in that part of the state, that doesn't really require a significant hike to get into. It is often the case in California that you will have to, after you drive to get somewhere, you'll have to hike for a good ways to get to the cave. And Rippled Cave on Weller Preserve, because of the nature of where it is, you can park and walk, oh, I think we measured it at, was it 100 feet?
140 feet.
140 feet, okay.
Yeah.
So that, combined with the fact that it's a very beginner-friendly cave, there are no non-obvious hazards. There's lots of interesting squeezes, including some that are too tight for me to ever get through. And it's not a heavily decorated cave, which is good news, bad news. It makes it good for beginners because there's less concern over incidental damage. It's also a little disappointing at times because it's always nice to have eye candy. It's also a really good spot for a vertical practice as well because of the nature of the cliff face, that you have a very forgiving place that you can walk up and rig a rope and walk up and down separately on the outside near an entrance. So it's really a great all-around introduction to caving sort of environment, and that's how it had been used for many years.
So you've got Weller, you're going to acquire the volcano property, and I'm sure that's what you're focusing on right now, Marianne, but where else have you had your eyes on acquiring land? It's a different beast out there, though, isn't it? I mean, before you can even think about it, you have to anticipate it being extremely expensive, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know whether we mentioned, we did buy another small cave very early in this last year. That's called Cave of the Catacombs, and it's down in Calaveras County. We ended up getting it for California very inexpensively. We paid $25,000 for 3 acres there.
Not bad.
And we got the main entrance of the cave. And the cave is flooded a lot of the year, but it's not very, very long. It's got some passage and a second entrance. And, you know, certainly you can make a little afternoon excursion out of it. But we had, several years ago, had our eye on a cave in Oregon called Marble Mountain Quarry Cave that came on the market. But at that time, they wanted over $1 million for it. And, I mean, that was just like, oh, my God, there's no way. We should probably revisit that at some point. I don't know what has happened with that property. And the guys that bought it had some big plans for it that I don't know whether it ever came to fruition or not. They buried the cave entrance, and at one time when they thought we were more serious about trying to purchase it, they unburied it, and we went in, several of us went in and finished a map of it and took a good look at what was there. I think at one time there had been an attempt to commercialize it, but it is in an old quarry. So as far as I know, it's still buried, but that would be, it's the longest limestone cave in Oregon. And it would be, maybe someday we'll be able to go back to that and see what we can do. I don't think there's, any potential more activity at the quarry as a limestone quarry, but I'm not sure about that. It looked pretty played out to me. Limestone or marble in this part of the country tends to occur in pods or, blocks. They're not continuous or anything. And that's a very good example of that is our Weller Preserve has this little pod of marble and a cave is in it and all the surrounding geology. You go 30 feet from the cave and you start getting into another kind of geology. So, and that occurs off and on throughout the Mother Lode area and further on up in the, toward Oregon and everything. Things occur in small areas. So we'll just have to wait and see. There is another cave in the near Cave of the Catacombs that recently came on the market, but it's a small cave and they want a lot of $200,000 for the property, and we can't afford it right now, and it has a house on it which we really wouldn't be interested in dealing with. So we, you know, these things come out of nowhere. I mean, I never expected this property to come on the market at Volcano, and yet it did. And so what our focus is on right now, after paying for this, is getting our finances in a position so that when another opportunity comes up, we will be able to move on it. So that's all we can do, I think, for right now.
What do you need from the caving community yet on Volcano?
Well, it'd be nice to raise another couple hundred thousand dollars. I think that's a difficult ask. But if we could raise another $100,000, it would really help us out a lot, because we would have to use far less of what we have saved up. We're going to try, especially through this spring, and hopefully if the convention happens, to do another real push at fundraising. And right now I'm trying to get a few more pledges for a matching grant, to get a few more individuals willing to put forth some money so that we can advertise that as if people give and match this $20,000 or whatever I can get together, that you'll end up doubling your money. So maybe that way we can raise a significant portion of what we need.
I had heard that there was a mine tunnel, an historic mine tunnel on the Volcano property. Is that true?
Oh, the Green Door.
Oh.
Yeah, you want to tell him about that, Stephen, or you know,
I think you're better qualified, but it's not really properly a mine tunnel so much as a water access, isn't it?
Okay.
I'm not sure what its origin was. I suspect its origin was during the Gold Rush period. It was probably a drain tunnel or something for the hydraulicking they were doing out there. But the current use is that I'm not sure exactly what the source of the water is, but apparently it taps into the water table somewhere, and it forms the water source for the whole town of Volcano. And the water dribbles out under the Green Door. They have a door to this tunnel, and it happens to be green. And that they're not drinking that, but they must have a pipe in there further. The realtor has encouraged us to ask the current landowner, Doug, to take us in there sometime, just so that we can go back. It's just interesting. Go back and see it and see what's in there and everything. And that will probably answer that question of where exactly they collect their water in there. But there's this little tiny square of, I don't know, like 15 feet square or something like that, that we will not own, that the town of Volcano owns. And they have a right of access to go in there and open the Green Door and go in and fiddle with whatever's in there.
So that's theirs, and you don't necessarily benefit from that, but it is on the property. Okay.
Yeah, Well, the property surrounds it.
Okay. It's like a Vatican City situation. I get it.
Exactly, yeah.
I never would have thought of that, but yes. The principality of the Green Door.
Yes.
back on a previous topic, before I forget, you were asking about, is it volcanic? So my understanding is the reason the town is called Volcano, although it is not volcanic at all, is apparently when the first miners were prospecting in that area, they came upon it, and it's basically sort of in a depression among a bunch of hills. They came upon it, and it was very socked in with mist and fog. And someone said, oh, this must be a volcanic caldera here, and this is the mist and fumes rising up from it. So they call the area Volcano, because apparently they had no knowledge of the right geology, and the name stuck, even though it's completely wrong.
Okay. I'm glad that we got that cleared up, because here I was seeing the word volcano, looking into all this and thinking, oh, we must be talking about lava tubes. I'm glad that.
Yeah.
For people who attend the weed convention, whether it happens this year or in a subsequent year, lots and lots of, volcanic cave activity in that area, and outright volcanoes, obviously Mount Shasta. But in the town of Volcano, not at all.
How far is Mount Shasta?
Mount Shasta is basically adjacent to Weed. I mean, it looms over it.
Okay.
I don't know how you
Oh, I was just going, yeah, it's just, I mean, when you sit in the town of Weed, if you get a clear view, you're just looking, it's like Mount Fuji sitting just a few miles away. And I was looking at the website the other day, and there's something I just have to do when I'm up there. And they're hosting a Mount Shasta four-wheel drive rally. And I have a four-wheel drive, and I just love that kind of thing. So I'm really excited about that. But there's all kinds of old logging roads and everything up there. So someone has gone through and mapped out a route for that activity. So
well, I mean, as long as we're talking about Weed, where the 2021 convention is going to be, I mean, you're both fairly longtime cavers. What is great around there? Like, what do we visit when we come?
Well, there's lots of lava tubes. Going east from Weed, of course, there's Lava Beds National Monument, which people, even the public, can go to and go through a whole range of lava tubes that are open. And then there's lots of other caves there as well that cavers can go through. Up on the Medicine Lake Highlands, which is up above Lava Beds and also to the east of Weed, there are wild lava tubes on national forest land. And there'll be led trips to those, and I'm sure there'll be a guidebook, and some of them will provide directions to the ones that are more easily accessed. Going to the west, of course, is the Marble Mountain Wilderness and all the caves that Stephen was talking about a few minutes ago. That, of course, is a 5-mile backpack in, so that'll be probably a post or pre-convention trip if they have something there. There's also limestone or marble caves around Lake Shasta, and there's Lake Shasta Caverns, and the grotto up there that is organizing all the cave trips, the Shasta Area Grotto, is, I'm sure, has some trips planned to a few of those caves that they can access. Caves will be predominantly lava tubes, but there will be some more traditional, quote-unquote, limestone caving. Then, of course, there's marvelous hiking up there, and just touring around, the landscape is fantastic, and so there's lots of things to do that way. But I think the caving opportunities, even for people who are not hardcore cavers, they can go to some place like Lava Beds or some of the closer lava tubes and just walk through them, and, you know, they're really fairly easy to maneuver through.
Stephen, you're...
It's also not far from Lassen National Park, which seems to not be as well known as I think it should be. And it's a major geothermal area. And, there are lava tubes in the area and in the park. That is of some interest. If lava tubes is really your interest, then Lava Beds National Monument is sorely not very well known. And it's amazing. There's literally hundreds of lava tubes across the park. But Lassen is, from anyone interested in geology in general, is a fascinating place to visit and highly recommended. You know, we talked about the difficulties of properties not coming up for sale very often out here, and so we have to work with various other entities. And sometimes that is a government entity. There's one cave that we manage, actually a cave area, that is in conjunction with another private land trust. And I won't go into the details of that on the podcast, but basically it's an area that bought a large tract of land for forest preservation purposes and did not realize that there was a subsection of it that had some pretty significant caves that had been off limits for legal access for decades. And we ended up agreeing with them to manage the caves for them because they didn't know they were there. They just assumed once they learned they were there, they thought this is kind of going to be a nuisance. And so we basically stepped in and said, no, don't. You should make these available, but you need people with expertise on how to responsibly manage caves, both in terms of preservation, of course, but also in terms of what responsible access is like. And that's one of the things that is often ticklish about trying to manage caves, is trying to determine what is the level of responsible access that any given cave can handle. Something that's kind of perplexed me over the years is there doesn't seem to be any sort of really objective way of measuring what is the level of traffic that a given cave can handle. And I realize that's partly because every every single cave is so wildly different. You know, what is the impact that the human visitation is going to have on the cave itself, or the biota in the cave, or even the humans itself? And it's been very hard to quantify in a way to justify to non-cavers what level of access is appropriate. Sometimes you just have to use by way of analogy, well, this cave is similar to this other cave that seems to be doing fine at this level of visitation. But, you know, I'm an engineer by trade, and so the lack of being able to put hard numbers and objective measurements on this sort of thing is often frustrating to me.
Yeah, I'm very curious about what it's like, what kinds of strategies you might implement verbally or you know, any kind of communication-wise to explain to non-cavers about this exact scenario, managing land for caver access, explaining to them, look, this is just this weird thing that we're into. We're not going to bother anything else. We just want to go in the caves. And then reaching or inching towards some sort of compromise with them. That's curious to me. So it sounds like you were able to actually kind of come to some kind of consensus with this property.
Well, yes
and
no.
It's a work in progress.
Oh, okay.
The good news is that after years of slowly working with them, we finally got to the point where we were able to upgrade to agree to actual recreational trips as opposed to trips with a specific purpose such as mapping or so forth. And we had exactly one of these recreational trips that occurred last year before the pandemic occurred. So, and once things got locked down, pretty much all recreational caving is certainly the conservancy is not authorizing any recreational trips on any of the caves we manage because they're all certainly too constrained in airflow to be considered to be a good idea for people to get together and breathe the air together at this point. Mm-hmm. So we are making an exception for trips that can be responsibly done that have a specific purpose, such as archaeological or scientific research. There's some very interesting studies going on with paleoclimate study research in some of the caves in that area. Ironically, by folks at Vanderbilt University, but there aren't many caves in sort of near the coast of California that are available to do studies in. And so this has been showing some really interesting results about what the climate over the past 10,000 years in California has been like.
Oh, man.
And so for things of that sort, we've been doing our best to make an exception. But recreational caving, yeah, I mean, I assume it's probably similar across most of the country, but I think it might be even more so out here because a lot of the caves that are commonly visited tend to have small passage.
Mm. Yeah, people out here, especially in the Bay Area, are very, very concerned about COVID. And I think there's probably more people complying with a mask requirement out here in urban California than there are in a lot of other places in the country. There's two things I'd like to say, and I don't mean to contradict you, Stephen, but I'm thinking about what a discussion we had with Raphael, our legal counsel, and I wanted to make clear to Matt that in the particular case of the project that he was just referring to, we don't actually manage the caves in a formal sense for this other organization. It's actually two organizations. I think we can safely say we assist management. Assist them to manage the caves. Because they still call all the shots. Every trip has to be approved, and right now they're very concerned about anyone accessing the caves because of there is a small group of bats, Townsend's bats, I think, that use one of the caves periodically, and their California Department of Fish and Wildlife has determined that the potential for humans to share COVID and or the coronavirus with other animals like bats is possible enough that they don't want to create a situation where there's an animal reservoir of that disease that is allowed to exist. So they're being very cautious about that. In contrast, the Windler Cave project, which we have an MOU with Stanislaw National Forest, they actually do turn over management of the cave to us. I mean, we make all the decisions about the trips and all that kind of thing. And it's a very pristine cave, and we limit the number of trips a year to preserve it. But they don't interfere with what we're doing as long as we maintain the road and there's no problems with the gates or access. They're happy to kind of wash their hands of it. And the other thing I'd like to say is that with regard to the project that Stephen was referring to, we have had to increase our insurance coverage to a $2 million umbrella because of their concerns about liability. We were very fortunate. We wouldn't have been able to enter an agreement with them at all without good liability coverage. And at the same time that project was kind of coming on board, we finally found an organization that caters to nonprofits. And so we were able to get really good insurance coverage for our directors and officers and for general liability, the whole nine yards. I think we're paying something over $3,000 a year for it, which is very reasonable. And that is something we really need in California, especially in any situation where we're working with another partner.
I'm really thankful that you're unpacking all of this. And I think the reason that I pressed on it to begin with is because we're kind of in a somewhat similar situation here in Indiana, where we as cavers want a number of caves on state land, actually, we want access to that again. But with white nose syndrome, it's been very, very sensitive, very difficult. And, you know, with as much time as has passed since the white nose closures in Indiana, it's kind of become the status quo. It's become the norm. It's become what the state is used to it being. And they, you know, as I'm sure you've run into, they don't quite understand cavers. They don't understand why we do it, why we want to protect it, why we want access, you know, and things like that. And so we kind of hit a wall with them. But we're inching toward a point where we can kind of where we have talked with the Department of Natural Resources here in Indiana, where we can kind of maybe begin managing access. We've kind of gotten there and then fallen back and gotten there and fallen back, but we're at least talking, that kind of thing. And so I guess if we could learn anything from you, then, you know, it's that kind of thing. So I appreciate it. And I know this is all very sensitive, so I do appreciate you saying as much as you can about it. You got to be careful. And there's a lot of talk that there's a lot of interesting negotiation tactics, I guess.
Yeah, and a lot of it is luck, too. But certainly we can learn from each other. You know, we share what we've learned with other conservancies. I don't know what the cavers are that you were talking about, whether you're talking about just NSS cavers or whether you have some kind of a conservancy there. But certainly a conservancy can get insurance. And, of course, through the NSS, certain activities are covered for all their organizations that are affiliated with them. And maybe presenting that information might make a difference in certain cases.
Yeah, yeah. Every situation is different. Ours is definitely complicated out here, for sure.
One other thing that comes into play in a situation like this is also managing what the local caver expectations are.
Mm. Oh, God, yeah.
Because you know, you have the problem of, from the conservancy's point of view, our goal is we want to make sure that we have a long-term access solution here. We want to play the long game and ensure that we have something that is as close to permanent understanding as we can get, and if not permanent, at least long term. And sometimes when you're working with an external landowner, whether it's, you know, federal or a private land trust, they're going to call the shots. And so in this one particular case, it's taken literally years for us to sort of build up the trust that they believe that we can be a responsible partner. And that delay, you know, some people are not happy with that. And that's understandable because, you know, when the only access was illegal, but it was still possible to sneak in, you could theoretically go anytime you wanted. And, you know, while we have been trying to persuade the recent landowners to loosen up legal access, it meant that access was constrained. And nobody's happy about that. But it's a problem that I don't think can be easily solved other than just by begging people for understanding and to take the long view.
All right. That is about our time. Is there anything else that you two wanted to share?
Is there anything that that we, or more particularly I, said, Marianne, that you think needs clarification?
No. It was just that one thing. And, of course, it was that particular point. It was why I think that we had such difficulty with some of the local cavers, because there was an impression that we were now in charge of the caves for this organization, and that we were the ones keeping people out, being too cautious. And there was some miscommunication, which I don't need to go into at all, but it was that feeling that we were the ones that were keeping them out, and we weren't. And it's just something we learned some lessons there that we're going to have to be a little more careful about making our position very clear with the local cavers, so that they understand exactly where we're coming from, and that, you know, and that we're on their side. I mean, after all, we're all cavers too. We want to go caving, and you know, we wouldn't keep them out unless, you know, our hands were tied or there was a really significant, you know, reason conservation-wise to keep people out. And we've been very upfront with the volcano purchase in talking to people and letting them know what our plans for access are and everything. And I think that's one reason why people have been as generous as they are. And I think we're getting back on a better track with local cavers through this.
Cavers across the country and even around the world hear this. Is there anything you want to say to the international caving community? It's mostly NSS people who listen to this, but
I would love to be able to encourage people around the world to make plans to come to the Weed Convention, because Northern California in the summer is a gloriously beautiful place, underground and above ground.
Ah.
This year, I understand it's a little hard to make advance preparations, so all we can do is cross our fingers and remind people that it is a beautiful place, and hopefully circumstances will permit people to consider coming to visit this year.
Yeah, I can't think of anything to add except for that building a conservancy is a very long game and it requires a lot of patience. But, you know, I love caving so much. And I really, I started caving in a period of time where access really wasn't a problem. And you could get together on a Saturday morning and decide where to go caving on the fly and just have a great day. And those days are kind of gone. And there's not going to be anybody around to care about caves if we don't continue kind of breeding new cavers. And the way to do that is to introduce people to caving, give them an opportunity to explore and to begin to love caves the way we do. And that's where we're going to get our next generation of people who take care of them. And so, you know, a conservancy that can help provide that kind of experience is becoming more and more valuable. And it's a hard job, but I think it's very worthwhile. And I would encourage cavers everywhere to, you know, consider this, if this is appropriate for their area, of getting involved in something like that and at least supporting it.
The Western Cave Conservancy is a major sponsor of the 2021 NSS Convention in Weed, California. You can visit their website at westerncaves.org. I'll put a link in the description of this podcast. Marianne Russo, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Stephen Johnson, thanks for your time, man.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Marianne. Thank you, Stephen. Thanks to Matt Bowers, who was very heavily involved in organizing the 2021 convention in Weed, California. Depending on circumstances, I'm planning on seeing you there. So if you're coming to convention, I'd love to meet you. Next month, I believe, I haven't done the interview yet, but I believe we're going to have Carol Vesely, who I read about in Deep Secrets, and who I've been corresponding with via email. So it's kind of cool to be, you know, talking to a caving hero. I mean, all of these people are caving heroes.
But anyway, if all goes well, that'll be April. Support our sponsor, El Spilio. Go to elspilio.com. Save $20 off any light or any regularly priced order over $300 with the promo code podcast at checkout. And support all our sponsors, past and present. Swago, swagogear.com. Get you a pack. I still got to get a push pack. I want one of the small ones. I have a pit pack. I love it, but I want something a little smaller. Also, Organic Robot Designs, Charlie Vetters has the brick and mortar store in Greenfield, Indiana, and also the Etsy shop. Organic Robot, all one word, on Etsy. Or you can just go direct to his website, organicrobotdesigns.com. If you need shirts made, a lot of Grotto's doing shirts. He'll do them for you, and he's a joy to work with. See, is that everything? I think that's everything. Thank you for listening. I'm Matt Pelser. Until next time, kill nothing but time.